Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO, in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, May the 29th, 2015, and May is International Respect for Chickens Month. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by our co-host, Alyssa Ray.
Hi there.
And our control room operator, Amir Ali.
Hello.
Jackie, Cynthia, and Tim are away today. Welcome, everyone. If you have an artistic inclination and you care about helping animals, have you ever thought about putting your artistic talents into action to spread the message of compassion for animals to the general public?
I have.
Yeah, me too.
That was rhetorical. But that's cool, because I didn't know that. Well, of course I did. Well, that's what Manitoba-based artist and longtime animal activist Twyla Francois has done. She has spent much of her life working to expose the cruelties against farmed animals via undercover investigations and rescue operations, and combines these two passions together to tell the stories of the animals she has encountered to raise awareness of the plight of farmed animals in a gentle and compelling way. She'll be here today to talk to us about performing animal activism through artwork, and we'll share some stories of the animals she has encountered and then painted. And then for our feature interview in honor of International Respect for Chickens Month, we have chicken expert Karen Davis on the show, who is the founder and president of the Virginia-based nonprofit organization United Poultry Concerns. I had a fantastic conversation with Karen earlier this week, where she shared with me a plethora of both anecdotal and factual information about the lives of chickens, explaining how they love to live in their natural environments and how that joy from their lives is stripped away in a way that we humans typically treat them in environments such as factory farms. She had many detailed stories to share, and as a result, I had to edit down our interview quite a bit in order to be able to fit it into today's show. And that truncated interview is coming up soon. However, if you would like to listen to the whole 37-minute interview for yourself, I will be posting it on our website in the posting for this show. So you can find it there at animalvoices.org, and I should be doing that by tomorrow.
So, looking at what happened over the week, there's something that's been making headlines that I wanted to address. So, on May 24th, Hannah, a Pacific white-sided dolphin imprisoned at the Vancouver Aquarium, sadly died. She was suffering from a gastrointestinal disease, and surgery was performed on her. There was vets that came from across the U.S. to perform this surgery that had never been done before. And shortly after the surgery, she passed away. Hannah was 21. She had spent 12 long years in a tiny tank at the Vancouver Aquarium. The lifespan of wild dolphins is around 40 years, so it was half of her natural lifespan, and it's a tragedy. She's not alone, though. There's 42 other cetaceans who have died at the Vancouver Aquarium. 42 other cetaceans have died at the Vancouver Aquarium. Pacific white-sided dolphins are the prized possessions of these whale jails, as they perform the most acrobatic acts that tourists pay a lot to go and see. Recently, I spent some time in Stanley Park. I was at a workshop there, and we had our lunch break, and I could hear the dolphin show, and I heard Hannah and Helen, the other dolphin there, performing their tricks, and I heard the lies that they tell about the dolphins there. And they say, you know, that they were rescued from fishing nets off
in Japan.
In Japan, yeah, and flown all the way over here. It just doesn't really add up. That's their story. So anyway, Helen is there alone for now. But anyway, I wanted to bring up one point that Annalisa Sorg mentioned. Actually, we're going to have her on the show next week to talk more about dolphins and cetaceans in captivity for our Empty the Tanks show. But Annalisa Sorg from No Whales in Captivity, a local group here in Vancouver, she is suggesting that Hannah committed suicide. She says that the Vancouver Aquarium vet told the media that Hannah looked at her whale jailers in the eye before taking her last breath, and then mm-hmm. her heart stopped.
And there was a quote on CBC News as well, straight from one of the people in the room with her that said that as well. So it's not just a rumor. And as people might know, is dolphins consciously decide to take a breath, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, and Rick yeah. O'Berry is a famous dolphin activist. He used to be on the TV show Flipper. Mm-hmm. He said that when he went to visit Kathy, one of the Flipper dolphins, who was stuck in a small tank alone, he said that he jumped in the tank, Kathy looked at him, took her last breath, and died in Rick's arms. Mm-hmm. And Rick O'Berry believes that Kathy committed suicide, and Annalisa Sorg of No Whales in Captivity believes that Hannah did as well. Pretty powerful. Interestingly, I'll mention a bit more in the news later at the bottom of the hour, but 2 days after she died, it was announced that a false killer whale named Chester would join the remaining dolphin in the tank. Chester was recently was rescued, and I'll talk about that a little bit more at the bottom of the hour.
Tune into The Reggae Show, Saturday 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. with your host George Barrett alongside Louis Sutherland, selecting the best roots rock, reggae, lovers rock, rocksteady, dancehall, dub, ska music, news and views. The Reggae Show on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, Saturday 6 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. Tune in, won't you?
All right, so speaking of cetaceans still, coming up in Vancouver, Saturday, June 6th, 11 a.m. until 1 p.m. is the third annual Empty the Tanks worldwide event. So there's events happening all over the world to oppose cetaceans in captivity. It's sending a strong message to the captivity industry that it needs to end. So join us in Vancouver at the aquarium here on June 6th at 11 a.m. Bring a sign if you can, or there'll be lots of extras. Bring your voice and come speak up for captive marine mammals all over the world. It's a family-friendly event. Last year, I think, was probably about 300 people.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I think I remember I did a count, and I think I counted closer to 400.
Wow, amazing.
So it's amazing. If only all animal activism protests were this big, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm really glad that at least this one is, because it's bringing people from different walks of life together, because we don't normally get that many people at regular demos, right? It's a really big one. It's worldwide.
It is. I think the general population can understand, cetaceans should not be in captivity. They're just like us. They have families yeah. just like us. They want freedom just like us, and they shouldn't be imprisoned in tiny tanks. It just makes
getting
sense.
There. And I think it has a lot to do with the film Blackfish that came out a couple years ago, too. That's really been getting the message out.
Definitely.
Something else coming up a little bit sooner than that is the Veg Expo, which is actually happening this Sunday at Canada Place. The theme is, it's bringing it back to basics on how you should look at food. You can discover the benefits of a plant-based diet, sample and discover new products and the services you can implement into your lifestyle, and to meet others that share the same passion. The topic of discussion this year is actually going to be green, sustainable living, and reducing our food print. And Allison, I think you mentioned there's going to be some animal groups there, like Liberation BC.
Yeah, I'll be volunteering there from 12 to 4 if you want to come say hi. So, and then Earth Save Canada, you mentioned.
Oh, right, yeah.
And a couple others, too, I heard. I can't quite remember what they were. But
and it's $15 at the door, but apparently if you go to the Meetup website,
So there's a new Meetup group. I think it's called Vegan Vancouver. So if you go to meetup.com, they just released a coupon code for $5 off for this week. So you might want to do that and save some money. I went last year. Amir, you didn't go, but did you go, Alyssa?
I am not interested in this particular event.
Okay. So Alyssa didn't go, but I went. I was interested. And so what it is, basically, it's a consumer-type trade show of all different vegan and vegetarian products. And I used to help organize a similar show that Ursave used to put on years ago called Taste of Health. And, boy, things have really changed. Last year was the first Veg Expo, and we've got so many vegan food products and so much interest and so many people to speak about it. So it's, and it was really packed too. So I really think this is a good way to get people who are maybe just kind of curious about leading a vegan lifestyle to learn about what things are all about here.
And finally, Saturday, May 30th at 2:30 p.m., the Direct Action Everywhere, or DXE, is meeting to host another demonstration against animal exploitation and abuse. This is, again, a worldwide event. And so the actions of DXE typically involve a short in-store portion and a longer, about half an hour, outdoor portion. It involves, chanting and a little bit of, drama inside a store that espouses exploitation. And if you want to know more about what they're doing or anything, you can just contact the local chapter of DXE. So again, that's Saturday, May 30th, 2:30, and it's at Jonathan Rogers Park in Vancouver. It's at Columbia and 8th at the corner there in the park, and they're going to meet to share the action plan and kind of practice it a bit and then walk together to the destination. So see you there.
You are listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
For our first interview today, we have Canadian animal activist and artist Twyla Francois on the show. You may be familiar with Twyla's past work for the animals that has included being the Canadian head of investigations for the international animal organization Animals Angels, the organization's Canadians for the Ethical Treatment of Food Animals, and the Canadian Horse Defense Coalition. Plus, she most recently served as the director of investigations for Mercy for Animals Canada, where she oversaw the completion and release of 7 groundbreaking undercover investigations. But Twyla has an artistic side as well, and she expresses the memories of the animals she has encountered by creating beautiful artwork to not only honor them, but to raise awareness of the plight of farmed animals in a more gentler, but hopefully equally compelling way. She is here to speak to us today about using artwork as a form of animal activism. Hello, Twyla, and welcome back to the Animal Voices show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today to speak to us about a form of activism for the animals that isn't the first thing you would think of when one thinks of how to raise awareness about animal rights issues. Can you start by telling us a bit about your own background and how you became connected to farmed animals and then how you got started in activism for the animals and working in cruelty investigations?
Sure. Well, I grew up in a small farming community here in Manitoba, and like most rural kids, I attended 4-H. I signed up for the animal husbandry course, and my best friend and I, and she was from a dairy farm, so we selected one of the calves. We groomed him. We took care of him for several months, and then when the town fair happened, we submitted him for judging. And as far as we understood, he was going to be judged on his beauty. And we realized that the person bidding on him was actually the town butcher. So we cried and cried and begged the organizers to please let us have our calf back. We don't want him to be killed. And they absolutely refused. And I found out later that it's actually a stated rule within 4-H. It's to crush compassion from budding farmers. And so it was that event that really made me decide to go vegetarian when I was 13. Then I ended up having a pretty average life, had a pretty regular straight job, and it was only after I got really sick and I required emergency surgery and a second surgery and 6 months of chemotherapy. And it was during that time when I was throwing up and couldn't get off the couch that I really reexamined my life and thought, you know, is this all my life is going to be, you know, just having a decent place to live rather than actually doing something for the world. And so I started a small local animal rights group. And what was incredible was immediately we started receiving really disturbing photos of pigs who were being abused. And it turned out that there was this collecting station, which is where animals are brought and reassembled before they're shipped to the major slaughterhouses across Canada and into the U.S. And so that ended up resulting in a nearly two-year investigation where I returned to the facility every single day gathering evidence. And ultimately, I was able to get that facility shut down.
Wow, I'm just so blown away by that whole story from beginning to end. I had no idea, and I just think it's really important for people to understand that, you know, we all have our own journeys, but wow, I'm just really impacted by that. So we're going to talk about art, and you're an amazing artist, as I've discovered from viewing the pictures on your website. Can you talk to us a bit about what your background is in art and then how you decided to bridge your two interests and skills together, that is animal activism and artwork?
Well, I actually had no formal art training. It was really just a means to cope. It started when I was at that assembly yard and I was seeing just the most horrific things. And, at the time I wasn't getting any media attention. So I had all this horrible imagery to try to process. And it seemed to help when I was able to sort of paint it out. And then more recently, I've realized that it can actually be a really effective educational tool. Because art allows a measure of freedom that we don't have with photo and video evidence. And it can actually be even more emotive and moving because much of the interpretation of the art is up to the viewer. And we know from psychological studies that having a sense of responsibility in making a decision is a catalyst for changing behavior. So when somebody views the art, and I tend to draw from left to right the same way that we read, so that, you know, they'll be pulled in by seeing a nice animal on the left, and then as their eye moves to the right and they see, for example, the hanging carcass, then they have this sense of discovery and a sense of ownership because they've just made the connection themselves, and hopefully they'll change that, you know, channel that into action.
I would have never known any of that, actually, if you hadn't just explained right now how that actually works on a psychological level. It's just like fascinating to me. And I wanted to speak a little bit more about how you said you didn't have a way to express before the interactions that you were having with these animals. So can you maybe just talk a bit about how it may be a cathartic release or an expression for yourself to honor the memories of these animals who you've had encounters with?
Yes, I make a promise to all of the animals that I try to advocate for that I'm going to tell their stories because a lot of times it's not a great, we don't have a great result. You know, I can advocate for one individual animal. There was one animal I advocated for 3 days. I stayed at an auction and advocated for her just to get her euthanized because there was no way of moving her. If she hadn't been euthanized, she would have been transported to the U.S. for slaughter. It just would have been a horrible experience. And so often that's kind of the best we can do is at least end their suffering. So I make that promise to them that I'm going to tell their stories. And painting them allows me to fulfill that promise. And it's also, to me, it's this educational component again, that if this randomly selected animal suffers so much, then that shows the public that, you know, that abuse is so rampant on all farms, whether they're factory farms or family sized.
Well, I want to speak a little bit about the portraits of the animals on your artist's website, which is twilafrancois.com. And I would love to hear a few stories about some of the animals featured there. In honor of International Respect for Chickens Month this month, I was wondering if you could tell us about Natty the Hen. You have drawn a beautiful portrait of her sitting on your shoulder, and I would love to know who she is.
Oh, Natty was the strongest relationship I've ever had with any being. I discovered her as a chick, her and her sister, actually, at a livestock auction. it was the end of the auction. They hadn't been sold. They're seen as completely worthless and disposable. They were about to be stomped when we literally scooped them out from under the man's boot. And we were on investigation at the time going across Ontario, and so we knew we'd be on the road for a number of weeks. We took them with us. They came to the hotels with us. And what was really astounding, they were the first chickens I'd ever experienced. And what was really astounding was they would cry and cry, and, you know, we were in the car for long periods of time, and we're thinking, are they hot? Are they cold? Are they hungry? What is it? And then Catherine, the investigator who was with me, put her hand on the chicks, and they immediately quieted down. And we thought, oh, my God, it's their mother's wing. They need that feeling of safety and security that they can only get from a mother. And it's really horrific when we think that all of Canada's 363 million chickens are born without a mother. They're hatched in these giant industrial drawers with hundreds of other chicks, and they never get to know a mother.
That's really touching. I'm wondering if you could tell the story of another animal of your own choosing, because you have so many beautiful pictures here, and it's hard to choose. Just, you know, we have limited time. So if you were to choose one of your own who you have honored in the past through one of your paintings, can you speak about that animal, please?
Yeah, I'll share the story about Wilbur. He was a pig that I discovered on the side of the highway. The trailer he was being taken to slaughter in, he was a Maple Leaf pig, en route to the slaughterhouse in Brandon. The trailer crashed, and pigs spilled out onto this busy highway. I heard it on the radio, immediately drove out to the site. I saw some of the pigs were getting hit by cars. Others were just being shot randomly by police. It was really unbelievable. And most provinces don't have any kind of plan to deal with livestock transport rollovers. And so this is a really common sight if you happen upon a trailer accident. I was lucky that I had just gone grocery shopping, and I coaxed Wilbur into the back of my Subaru with some vegan yogurt, which he developed a huge taste for the rest of his life.
Aww.
Yeah, he climbed into the back of my Subaru, and I brought him home. And what was amazing, he was the first pig I really got to know. And he was extremely talkative and demonstrative, and he loved holding huge conversations with anyone who he met. He would just chatter on, and he loved blankets and affection. And I even put a dog collar on him. Of course, it was, you know, it was a whole leash because he had a giant neck. But he really made me realize that pigs are just so much like dogs. And for me, that was another pivotal moment where I realized, you know, all of these animals feel the same. It's just how we feel about them that differs, and that dictates what we'll allow to happen to them.
Well, I have to say, I'm so happy you chose to speak about Wilbur, because he's my favorite one. I totally want to buy this painting from you, by the way, because I was looking at it and I'm like, that's the one I have to get. And he's wearing a collar and he has a smile on his face and he's looking his head's out the window of the car, your Subaru.
Yeah, he's just so dog-like, and I thought, you know, that this image really captures his dog-like qualities and the moment of his rescue.
Okay, well, thank you so much for sharing. I wish we could just do like a whole hour of sharing stories here. Maybe, who knows, maybe we'll call you again one day to do more sharing. So on your artist website, you say that your work seeks to challenge our basic beliefs about farmed animals and foster a sense of compassion to all animals. Can you talk to us just more about that and how one can effectively use art as activism to raise awareness?
Well, I've already touched upon a bit of that, but much of my work really seeks to recast farmed animals to show what I learned, that they're just as worthy of our consideration as companion animals are. And my background is in psychology, and humans are social animals. And when we don't know how to react in a certain situation, we look at others to determine how we should feel about the situation and how we should react. And so seeing someone you know, lovingly providing water to a dehydrated sow at a livestock auction, or gently holding a piglet the same way they would a puppy, really changes people's view of those animals. And that's the goal of much of my work, is just to remind people that farmed animals are just as capable of suffering and just as deserving of our kindness.
Yeah, I think that just says it so well, and I think that we need to see more artists using their talent in this kind of animal activism. One final question is, as I mentioned, you do have these paintings and portraits as for sale as prints on your website. Maybe you can tell people a little bit about that and how to find them and how they can have one of your works as one of their own portraits in their home.
Definitely. So you can go to my website, twilafrancois.com, and then click on the Buy Prints. And my prints are sold through Fine Art America, which is a really brilliant service, because you can pick how you want the image. So you can get a print for as low as $27, and it's on really high-quality archival paper, so the colors won't fade. So you can pick, you know, paper, canvas, however you'd like it. But one neat thing about Fine Art America that, to me, is really useful for activist art is you can also buy covers for your phone or throw cushions. You know, I don't think I want my art to be seen and to be a conversation starter. So, you know, having this compelling piece of art on your phone cover every time you pull it out to talk, and inevitably people ask about it, and it's a perfect opportunity to educate people.
Yeah, and when I was going through the website myself, I think it's just an amazing tool for artists to showcase and sell their work. And so you have so many different options and different price points as well to make it affordable for everyone. So I really love that, and being able to use tools like this to get the message across. Well, thank you, Twyla, for coming on the show today to speak about your lovely artwork for the animals and how one can use their artwork as activism for the animals. To see Twyla's artwork and to purchase any of that, you can go to her site at twylafrancois.com. There's also a link to that at our website at animalvoices.org. Thank you so much, Twyla. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
You're listening to Animal Voices, and that was our interview with Twyla Francois. Her art is just so beautiful. I'm so glad we shared her story on the show, and I hope people really check out her art. It's just so colorful and beautiful, and I love artivism.
I love Wilbur. I love and all the rest of them, too.
Beautiful. So I wanted to mention a couple news stories. I have a couple Canadian stories and one from China. So first off, something that Twyla mentioned was a semi-trailer carrying animals crashed. That's how she picked up Wilbur. Is that right?
That's right. It was the same kind of thing. So kind of scary to think this actually happens. It's called a livestock transport rollover.
Yeah, not a fan of the word livestock, but that's what it's known as in the mainstream. But of course, we here at Animal Voices know that animals are so much more than just stock and property. So what happened was recently in a small town in Saskatchewan, a semi-trailer hauling 6,500 live chickens crashed on the side of the road. So the driver veered off onto the shoulder and he tried to veer back into the road, and his whole load shifted, sending many hundreds of the birds into the ditch there.
That's horrific.
And as Twyla said, there's no plan for these, even though they happen, you know, semi-frequently. There's no plan for what authorities should do in these cases. And very often they're just left to die on the side of the road, or they're shot. I didn't really get an update on what actually happened after the accident, just, you know, knowing that they died horrifically.
Where did you say this happened again?
It was in a small town in Saskatchewan.
Saskatchewan, okay.
So 200 kilometers, I think, from Saskatoon. So, of course, you know, it's a tragedy, but all animal transport trucks are headed towards tragedy. They're all heading to slaughter, and you know, what's better, dying on the side of the road, well, or having your throat slit while you're hung upside down with no anesthetic? I mean, they're both terrible. And I think if anything, these kind of stories get the public thinking about the transport of animals to slaughter. And it helps, you know, remind people that this is happening, mm-hmm. and that it's needless. And yeah, our transport like rules in Canada are terrible, and they often go for a long time without any like water or respite.
I remember we did an interview about that before. People want to look that up, transport on animalvoices.org. We are really lacking regulations in that area.
Yeah, and I just wanted to mention a couple other things. One news this week, it is no longer legal to buy or breed a killer whale in Ontario. So Bill 80 introduced new legislation for the province's marine mammal industry. It received its third and final reading in the legislature on Thursday. One of its new regulations is a ban on the acquisition of orcas, effectively making Kiska, imprisoned at Marineland, Ontario's last ever captive killer whale. Facilities which owned a killer whale prior to March 2015 are allowed to keep them. It is, like, there's some confusion about what it might mean exactly. So Kiska, who is approximately 40 years old, was captured as a calf near Iceland in 1979. So there's a bit of hope, I guess, for the future of, you know, no more killer whales there. But it's kind of confusing about what it might mean. Anyway, it's right. considered, some people were fighting very long and hard to make this a reality, and they're counting this as a success. And finally, just quickly here, China has committed to phasing out the domestic manufacture and sale of ivory products for the first time.
Wow.
Conservation groups said the announcement was the single greatest measure in the fight to save the last African elephants from poaching. And a group called Wild Aid, they're an anti-trafficking group, they said the announcement was significant, but they're waiting to see whether the pledge will be acted upon. And what follow-up there'll be. There's no time scale for this phase out. So, it's hopeful, but maybe not. A recent survey showed that 95% of Chinese supported a total ban on ivory sales, and this move has the potential to be huge in reducing poaching in Africa. In Africa, more than 22,000 elephants are killed for their tusks each year.
Well, thank you for the news, Alyssa.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
For our feature interview today for International Respect for Chickens Month, we have Karen Davis on the show. Karen is the founder and president of United Poultry Concerns, which is the world's foremost nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the respectful treatment of domesticated fowl. UPC runs a haven for chickens in Virginia and also teaches people about the egg and chicken meat industries, the natural lives of free chickens, pleasures and benefits of human-chicken companionship, and alternatives to chicken farming and the use of chickens in education and scientific experimentation. In the time that we have for this interview today, Karen will be touching upon some of these issues that face the world's chickens today. Hello, Karen, and welcome to the Animal Voices radio show.
Oh, hi. Thank you, Allison. I'm delighted to be on your show today.
Well, I think that we can safely say that you can be called an expert when it comes to understanding not only the many societal issues that face chickens today, but also the behaviors of chickens in both their natural and unnatural environment. First, I'd love you to start by having you tell us your story about how you became to be personally connected to chickens yourself.
Yes, Allison. Well, I did not grow up around chickens, even though I grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania. But when I started reading about animals and animal rights in the early 1980s, that's when I became acquainted with chickens. I was one of the first volunteer interns for Farm Sanctuary, which was just getting started in the mid-1980s. And a huge experience for me was when my then husband and I moved to a little place that we rented in Maryland, where it turned out that our landlady was raising a small flock of chickens for tax purposes to get tax exemptions. I began to visit these birds every day when I discovered them accidentally in June. They were in a little shack a few yards from the little house that we were living in, and I was walking down the path, and I heard a murmur going on inside this shack, and I saw some feathers floating around, and I went around, and I untied the little latch to the door and went in, and there were about 75 chickens. They were the large white chickens, the kinds who are sadly bred and raised for the chicken meat industry. So at that time, I was just starting to learn about farmed animals in particular, and about chickens. And I had read Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, and what really drew my attention was the descriptions in his book of the birds and other animals in industrial farming operations and in laboratories. So I had a little bit of a background when I met these birds, but I saw how huge and large they grew in a very short amount of time. I saw that they tended to be crippled. And one day, after about 6 weeks, during which time I would visit them every day in the afternoon, and they would gather around me when I would sit on the dirt floor with them, and they were just so sweet and so friendly and attentive. So one day I went down to visit them, and they were gone. And I peered inside, and I saw some movement inside, and I went in, and under a shelf that was full of farm equipment and old rusted junk, I saw this little hen who I gathered in my arms. She was very thin, and she was very lusterless, and her eyes were unfocused, and it was clear she had not gotten enough to eat, and that she was probably left behind either because nobody saw her. She was left behind from the people who gathered her up to take gathered the birds up to take them to slaughter. But if she was left behind, so maybe, too, they felt she wasn't large enough to bother with. But anyway, I took her up the little path to the house where my husband was in the kitchen, and he named her Viva because she was the one who lived. And so that was really my first experience with chickens, where I spent time with a chicken and got to know her. And she was just very sweet and very affectionate and very attentive. So Viva was really very instrumental in my decision to start United Poultry Concerns in 1990. I met her in 1985, and meeting her and then subsequently working for 5 weeks for Farm Sanctuary when they were still a very, very tiny operation in Avondale, Pennsylvania, and meeting the chickens there and the turkeys and the ducks, I've always had a very strong affinity for birds my whole life, but I didn't know these birds. And so I loved all of the farmed animals. They were all new to me. And the chickens and the turkeys and the ducks, and also there were two geese, I was just so drawn to them. And I loved to go into the little pen where the chickens were because they would all run up to me, and if I would lie down on the ground, they would walk all over me, and they would peck gently at my hair, or I guess pick off any little pieces of, the grooming, in other words, any little flecks of anything that they were very, very gentle with their beaks. And I just fell in love with chickens, and so meeting them personally, getting to know them that way, and simultaneously educating myself through reading Animal Liberation and other books about the modern poultry industry, led me to decide to start an organization that would focus attention particularly on chickens and turkeys, because these birds are the largest number of abused land animals on the planet.
So I want to talk a bit more about that. I know that as part of United Poultry Concerns, you run a chicken sanctuary. Can you tell us a bit about the sanctuary, how many chickens you have, and what kinds of situations you have rescued them from?
Yes, well, we do have a sanctuary, and I actually started taking in rescued chickens shortly after I met Viva, in the, around 1986 or so, 4 years before I incorporated United Poultry Concerns as a nonprofit organization. And my experience meeting chickens, I just love them. The more I met them, the more I liked them. Our chickens over the years have come from various sources, certainly from the chicken meat industry. We are located on the eastern shore of Virginia, and this whole mid-Atlantic area is one of the largest chicken producing areas in the United States. So many of the birds we've had over the years have come from the Purdue Tyson chicken type operations, the kind of birds that Viva was when I met her and her companions. We've taken in many hens over the years from the egg industry, and then we've taken in a number of chickens and turkeys, and we also have two male guinea fowl, and they have come from various humane societies, both in Maryland and in Virginia. And we just took in a rooster from a cockfighting background in Manassas, Virginia, which is a couple of hours outside Washington, D.C. So this rooster, a lot of people think that roosters from cockfighting backgrounds cannot be rehabilitated, can't live normally with other chickens. And Monarch is doing great. He's a very gentle rooster. He's got seven adoring hens, and they're out there enjoying themselves in the yard right now. And we've had other roosters from cockfighting operations, as well as hens. So we've basically had, over the years, just about every type of chicken.
So before you were talking about how we know chickens to be the most abused land animals on the planet, and I think if more people knew exactly why this is, perhaps they would reconsider the way they use their money and carry out their eating habits to perpetuate this cruelty. So if you had just a couple of minutes, as you do now, to impress upon just an average person why chickens are so largely mistreated by humans, and perhaps this is the first time they're ever hearing this, what would you say to them to try to make an impact?
Well, I'm always saying to them, try and make an impact one way
so
or the other.
So what do you say to them, right?
Well, I point out that these chickens, I let people know where chickens come from, that they come from a world of sunlight. They have excellent eyesight. They have excellent hearing. They have full color spectrum vision. They are very vivid birds with very powerfully developed senses, and they are very social birds, and they are very intelligent and very emotional. And here they are being locked up in these filthy, dark, industrial compounds, these long, 500-foot-long sheds. Somebody writing for The Guardian a number of years ago described opening the door of one of these sheds filled with many thousands of baby chickens, because they're all babies. If they're raised for the meat industry, they go to slaughter at around 6 weeks old. He said what a shock it was to see these young chickens, not only because they were so huge and because the shed was so filthy and so full of burning ammonia fumes, but their behavior, he said, they were just a sea of stationary gray objects. Not a sound came from them, no movement, nothing. And I tell people to realize what we've done to chickens, that we have taken this lively, curious, interested, and interesting bird, not only from their natural homes, but we have dismembered their family life. We have deprived them of their earth rights. We have taken them from the earth, which they love, from the sunlight. We have stripped them of all comfort and all joy. And we have put them in these dark, filthy, colorless places. That's how chickens are raised. They're raised in almost complete darkness. So they keep them in the dark so that they will do nothing but just sit and eat and turn into a pile of meat. So these birds, naturally, living the way they are forced to live, their immune systems cannot cope with the load of disease organisms. That's one of the big issues. They suffer from so many diseases. I've really discussed in detail in my book, Prisoned Chickens, Poisoned Eggs, An Inside Look at the Modern Poultry Industry, some of the major diseases, what they call production diseases, diseases that chickens and turkeys would never normally suffer from and never normally suffered from before they began to be collected into these huge, crowded, filthy conditions without any natural sunlight, where their immune systems are overwhelmed with the psychological stress and the physiological stress and just trying to fight off all the effects of filth and infirmity. So, you know, you have these birds being sick, and they're not healthy, and they're not a health food. And a lot of people have the idea that if they're eating a white chicken breast, that somehow that whiteness is the equivalent of purity or cleanliness or healthiness or who knows what. But the thing is, a lot of that whiteness comes from the chlorine and things that they use in the slaughterhouses to cover up wounds and bruises and other things that these birds go to slaughter. All animals who are raised for meat in our society are the equivalent of veal calves. They are kept very, very crowded and very stationary. And this goes back in history. This is not new. It's just the numbers. Keeping animals very, very crowded and stationary so that their muscles will not develop. This is how animals raised for food are kept. They are intended to be stationary. They are kept stationary so that their muscles won't develop, because when the muscle develops, then it becomes tough and stringy, and it's a muscle that's been used. They also don't want the animals, certainly these birds and other animals, to move, because that's considered to waste food, what they call feed. They don't want to spend money feeding birds that will turn into energy. They only want the feed to turn into either a big pile of meat or a great big bunch of eggs, or in the case of cows, a big bunch of milk. And so really there's no way that you can exaggerate the agony of chickens and turkeys and other birds raised for food. One of the things that I let people know is that every piece of bird flesh from a standard commercial operation was riddled with electric shocks, because when the birds go to the slaughterhouses, we have two huge slaughterhouses just up the road from where we're located here in Virginia. When the birds are trucked to the slaughterhouses, they're roughly grabbed out of the transport crates. They're hung upside down by their ankles and clamped onto the disassembly line, the conveyor belt. And they are dragged through electrified water. It's cold, salted, electrified water. Now, this is as much agony as you can inflict on a living, sentient being. This water trough is called a stun bath, an electrified water bath, stun bath. But everybody needs to understand that in no way are these birds either stunned, that is rendered pain-free and unconscious, nor are they intended to be stunned. They are intended to be paralyzed. So while they're fully conscious and being tortured with electric shocks going through their eyeballs and their eardrums and their hearts and their whole body, the purpose is to immobilize, that is to paralyze, the muscles of their feather follicles so their feathers will come out more easily after they're dead. But again, people will say, oh, that's horrible, that's factory farming, but, you know, old-fashioned farmers wouldn't do that. Well, yeah, they would. It was really in the 1930s that the use of electricity in poultry slaughter plants began to be used, just as special slaughter plants were being developed into what they have become today. But traditionally, for example, and I'm sure on some small farms, maybe many small farms to this day, they would hang the birds upside down and then take a sharp knife And there's a groove in the roof of the mouth inside, and they would take that knife and dig that knife up into the brain of the bird to scramble the brain so that the muscles are paralyzed. So one of the points, and sometimes go through their eye as well. So a point I always want to get across to people is that the way we treat chickens and turkeys today in vast, horrible factory farming conditions has precedent in the way they were treated before factory farming became established in the mid-20th century. The attitudes toward the birds, that they are a resource to be used, that God or somebody put them here or nature put them here to be used for us, and that we have a right to treat them however we want as long as we do it, quote-unquote, humanely, to satisfy everybody's concern if anybody does have a concern. But the thing is that, like the beaking of hens in the egg industry and turkeys also in the 1940s, as gradually chickens were being increasingly confined and taken off the earth and being driven to peck at each other, not because they're cannibals, not because they're aggressive, but because chickens are natural-born foragers. They spend a huge amount of their day digging with their claws and their beaks in the ground. And anybody who spends any time around chickens, if they visit our sanctuary, they will see that chickens forage in the ground. That is their nature. That's how they evolved. And their beaks and their claws and their whole being, all of these working together are designed for that kind of exploratory and food-finding behavior. And also they enjoy doing that. So when suddenly they are taken off the earth and everything that makes them who they are, that their whole neurophysiology and all of their anatomy, suddenly, none of this has any opportunity for expression. So, for example, when a chicken has nothing to, normal or natural to peck at, then, and they're frustrated and they are, well, even wanting to take a dust bath, for example, which for a chicken is the equivalent of our taking a water bath. It's the main way they practice bodily hygiene along with preening their feathers. Scientists discovered in the 20th century that one of the reasons that hens in battery cages will begin to pick at each other is because they are trying to make a dust bath. They begin to actually perceive the feathers of their cage mates as earth, earthy material, because they don't have any material in the cages. So they will actually begin pulling out each other's feathers in some cases, not because they're cannibalistic or aggressive, but because they are trying to exercise their inborn need to take a dust bath. For them, getting that earthy material, those particles into their feathers and into their skin, and spending about 20 minutes just rolling in the earth and then shaking all that out is just... That's what they do. And if they are put in an environment where they cannot exercise their natural behaviors and needs and interests, then those needs and interests will be expressed in an abnormal way, such as pecking at each other. So again, I get back to the fact that factory farming was not created by some corporate entity with no connection to farming. It grew out of farming. So there's a lot, again, to learn about the poultry industry. But again, people need to understand that in Asian countries, factory farming has gone on. I mean, crowding birds, keeping them in horrible, filthy conditions in rural areas and then taking them into the cities. This has gone on for centuries. So we can't be looking at animal consumption, poultry consumption, egg consumption as something that is anomalous, that somehow came out of the blue in the mid-20th century and has no antecedents, and that somehow we should be going back to an earlier time when chickens were treated so-called humanely, or to mimic, you know, non-Western cultures, because really there's nowhere to go back to, and there's nowhere when you really begin to learn about how animals considered a food source have been treated by all cultures throughout the world, you get a very different picture of the reality of things than if all you are focused on is where it all led to, which is the hell on earth that billions and billions of chickens and other farmed animals are now subjected to in the food producing systems throughout the world.
Well, thank you so much for that, Karen. I'm just really grateful for you taking the time to shed light on all of these issues. And these are just a few of them, of just some of the issues facing chickens today. And I really hope that people listening to this program will really take that information in and understand a bit more why it is that we have International Respect for Chickens Month and why we need to respect them. To find out more about Karen's work at United Poultry Concerns, please visit the website upc-online.org. Thank you, Karen, and have a great day.
Thank you, Allison. You too. Thank you.
My name's Alyssa. You're listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Vancouver Co-op Radio, broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories. I really enjoyed that show, especially because it was strong women's voices, and women make up about 80% of the animal rights, animal liberation movement, and I love to hear powerful women speaking up about how they dedicate their lives to protect animals. So next week's show, we're going to have another woman talking about her work. Annalisa Sorg is the founder and director of No Whales in Captivity, a local group here in Vancouver. She's going to be talking about the third annual worldwide Empty the Tanks event and what's going on at the Vancouver Aquarium that we need to know about. And let's see. So if you want to stay in touch with Animal Voices, make sure to go to our website, animalvoices.org. And there you can connect with us via our Facebook or Twitter. Keep in touch. We really want to hear from you, too. So if you want to hear something more on the show or you want to give us some feedback, you know, we're really keen to hear that. You can drop us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. The song we're hearing now is Chicken Song by Will Tuttle. Thanks so much for listening to our show today. We'll see you next week on June 5th. And remember to try to honor the chickens this month for International Respect for Chickens Month. Take care. Remember to be kind to animals. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.